Fam, do you know what it is to be unbothered? I'm not talking about not giving a damn. In fact, I found that unbothered folks are usually the main ones that get plenty of damns. Now, when I ask you about being unbothered, I'm talking about riding for your viewpoint so hard that you don't care if your opinions makes you unpopular. Strange concept, I know. Especially now, with everyone addicted to social media, we often confuse getting likes with being liked. I'm guilty of this, just like you, I'm guessing. But when you make your living contextualizing pop culture, politics, and sports, you can't care what people think. Well, at least you can't let them think you do. Enter stage left, Emmy winner, sports journalist, Jemele Hill. You've enjoyed her nuanced opinions about everything from Trump to the WNBA, online, on TV, on podcasts. Look, Jay is about getting that bag, so she's everywhere. And because of that, you probably think you know her. But as Jemele shared in our transparent conversation, I believe there are a few things you might not know, like how stepping foot in the newsroom detoured her dream to become a novelist, how she stands on the shoulders of women who raised and shaped her, and how she died. Yeah, died. Enjoy Jemele sharing truths, fam. After you experience our humorous conversation and her work in progress, you'll be inspired to become unbothered yourself as a storyteller. You'll also know more about the trials and triumphs of women in journalism. You'll be schooled in the craft of sports and memoir writing. And you'll question, why in the hell do we need to learn geometry? I mean, like, seriously. Hey fam, I'm your host Moniece, and welcome to Works in Progress, Conversations with Storytellers.
Thank you for having me.
Come on in, girl.
Ten toes down, Jemele Hill.
Girl, I'm so glad you came. you made the trip, girl.
Thank you for having me.
Know this, girl. Ooh, that right there. You can have a seat.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, have a seat. Have a seat. All right. Jemele.
Well, always good to be in conversation with you, so thank you for having me on your show.
Yes, what up, though, Jemele?
What up, though?
What up, though?
As someone said to me the last time I was in Detroit, what up, though, is both a statement and a question.
Okay, right? Break it down for the people who are clueless.
So what up, though, is how Detroiters greet one another. Like, if I really want to know if you're from the Detroit, I just say, what up, though? And the proper response back is also, what up, though? So it goes like
that. It's a question, it's a statement.
It's a question, it's a statement. It's our way of saying, hey, how you doing?
Right. Mm-hmm. So that being said, let's get to the real important question that Detroit's asking each other. East side or west side?
West side! All day, west side. No, and it is funny because I know that in every city you have your own language, right? And you know, even we're here in Los Angeles and they certainly do play the same geography games that we do. But in Detroit, you know everything about that person based off what side of town they grew up on
yes.
And what high school they went
exactly.
to. Exactly. Those are the two
All
most
the
important
you know.
Questions you can ask any Detroiter.
Yeah.
But what's funny to me about being from the west side, and yeah. I've had to say this to my west side people. I can't let the east side people know this. like, we act like we so much better than the east side. But like,
come on now.
Look, they might have Mac and B-Wick. We got Schoolcraft, dog. Like, we can't.
And it was a whole dance with the Schoolcraft.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I'm just saying. It was. West Side.
Yeah, same.
Joy Road.
I grew up on Joy Road and Lauder.
Oh, see, yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
So I lived in multiple places on the west side. 7 Mile and Asbury Park.
Okay,
Joy Road and Lauder. Pembroke between Monica and Pembroke.
See, that's real. That's real deep west side.
That's deep west around. Side.
That's a deep west side.
Yeah.
See, my neighborhood high schools were McKenzie and Cody.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but my mama.
No disrespect to Cody.
I'm just saying.
And I can't talk. I went to Mumford, so
well.
It was a little more elevated. But yes, I went to Mumford. But McKenzie, also in Wyoming, we used to commonly refer to them as that other school in Wyoming.
The other school.
We the school in Wyoming. They that other school. I know, because we petty. We have no.
I know. You gotta. Yeah. You know, we have to find ways to just talk mess
about
each
celebrate.
Other.
And to celebrate Detroit.
Well, and to celebrate. Yeah. I mean, because I didn't understand East Side till I went to King High School.
Oh, so you went to King.
I went to King.
Oh.
See, I was in an MSET program.
I was going to say, see, for those who are watching, understand King is one of those high schools. It's like,
it wasn't at first, though.
But you have to test in to get into King.
Well, yes.
Yes, that's the difference. It's like it's three high schools in Detroit you have to test into, and that's one of the three. It's King, yes. Cass, and Renaissance. So you are.
I didn't get into Cass or Renaissance.
But you got into King.
I got into King.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But King was the engineering program.
Yes, it was.
And I looked at my mama like, seriously, have you met me? Why am I going to the engineering program?
Were you good at math?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm dyslexic with numbers. Girl, it was, But she, you know, my people, did your people work in the Ford and Chrysler?
Some of them did, yeah. Yep,
so she came from that engineering background situation. So
gotcha.
She wanted to be an engineer, even though I was an alien, the creative kid. She was like, you need to eat. So go ahead and get this.
Get this stable job going.
Get this stable job. Learn calculus and algebra. Oof. I'm like, what? I can't even do subtraction that well.
That
what
was my kryptonite. Like, maybe this is something, I don't know if it's a blind spot every creator has, and certainly writers.
Yeah.
But most of the writers and journalists I know, just math is the kryptonite. And so that was never my strongest subject, and neither was science. But I got through, you know.
You did well enough. You got the C's.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Strangely enough, pre-calc and algebra, I was actually really good at. I was not good at geometry or trigonometry. I have no idea.
No, geometry makes no sense.
Geometry is useless. Okay. Trigonometry, I haven't used anything related to trigonometry in my life ever. Like, ever in life. Why are y'all abusing these kids?
I don't know. But see, I failed all of my math.
Did you?
I did. But I worked so hard at it, and I was so good at everything else, teachers just felt sorry for me. But then I got to the 12th grade and had to take calculus.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it all made sense.
Same. I got to 12th grade, had calculus. I was great at it. I got an A both times.
I think it's the relationship between, because it's all the maths coming together and the relationships. And I had a really great teacher who taught math telling stories. She was a storyteller.
Okay. Now that makes a lot of sense.
Suddenly I was like, oh.
I get it now.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mother used to get so frustrated with me. See, she's the opposite. She doesn't like reading. She loves math and science and things that she feels like come to a logical conclusion, like a definitive conclusion. So we were opposite brains. And I think sometimes that's probably why we had some conflict, because I think of things. I know I upset my husband with this sometimes. It's like, I need context. Like,
yeah.
Like if you say like, you can't park there. Okay. Well, why? Well, what's going on? What kind of neighborhood is it? Like, I'm asking 7 or 8 follow-ups, cause I need to understand the full picture of the situation.
Right.
Right. And, I know that my mother is more of a black and white, you know, kind of person. So she was really good at math. And so when she would do my homework with me, she would just be at her wit's end, because she could not understand why I didn't get it. And, you know, I told her, I was like, I should have reported you, because she would do the thing where we would be in the grocery store and she would, you know, pay. And then she turned to me and say, well, how much change am I supposed to get back?
Oh,
and I'm like, now you're
right.
Put me on the spot.
That ain't right.
And I'm like, you know, sitting up there, and she was like, people gonna be cheating you your whole life because you don't know how to count your change. I was like, I do know how to count, but you have just totally traumatized me
in the middle of
in the middle of this Kroger's or Farmer Jack's, because you know that's a
Farmer Jack's. That was a joint.
So like, I was like, you've traumatized me. So now I really have an even poorer relationship with math, because every time I see numbers, it's just gonna remind me of this moment and this trauma. So just know I have something new to talk about with my therapist, Mom. Thank you.
We just jumped right into the Detroit thing. I didn't introduce you, girl.
Oh, yes. I guess we got to talk. That's what happens when Detroit gets together.
I know that's what happens. But, I mean, you know, for people watching, listening, if you don't know who Jamil Hill Wallace is.
Can we give it on my whole government? I had warrants out here. Give it on my whole government. But yes, Jamil Hill, I still go by that.
Yes.
Like, it is more of a stage name, which probably sounds pretty curious to people, because...
Yeah, please explain.
Yeah. When I got married in 2019, I did change my last name. So legally says one thing, commercially something else. So
yeah, I had to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but you were living with that for so long, actually, and that's how you're known.
Correct.
Right?
It was mostly because of that. Like, my name, my reputation, you know, I've been a journalist now, a sports journalist now for 30 years. I think I'm at 30. Not quite right. So this is why journalists can't do math. My first professional year was 1997. So I'm coming upon that. So I'm okay. 20 plus years in, almost 30 years mm-hmm. in this game. And so given my career, 12 years at ESPN, 10 years in newspapers, done a lot of stuff. And so by the time we got married, that reputation was fully built.
Solidified at that point. Yes. Yeah. 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 So journalism. I know why I got into journalism, because my mama wanted me to eat. Poetry ain't gonna feed you. Mm. Playwriting ain't gonna feed you. Mm. Why journalism?
So for me, journalism was something that I didn't necessarily envision for myself in the beginning. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write books, you know, fiction novels, because I was a voracious reader. I was a curious kid. I'm sure you can relate to these things.
Yeah, yeah.
I was always in the library.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love storytelling. I also love sports. I mean, I was a neighborhood tomboy. I played a lot of sports. Like, so it was a natural marriage, because back in those olden times,
the
boys and
days.
Girls, we had to read something called a newspaper. Right? So that's how you kept up with your sports team.
Yes.
And so reading the newspaper helped me develop an appreciation and love of sports writing and sports storytelling. And so when I was in high school, I started working for my high school newspaper as a sports writer. And then they had a program where the Free Press actually published all the high school newspapers.
Yeah.
See, right. So
yeah, I was part of that too.
You were part of that program. Yeah. Okay. So like you opened up the regular edition of the Free Press, and in the middle was an insert with every high school newspaper. And it was just one page. So it was just like a small insert. And that meant once a month we had to go down to the Free Press to put the paper together.
And what was that like walking into a real newsroom?
So that's what got me.
It got
its hooks in me, because you walk into a newsroom and if you've seen any movies from the 70s and 80s, what newsrooms were like. It's like energy, freneticness, shouting. I was just standing there like, oh my God, these people do this every day.
Right.
And it was so transformational for me. Mm. And so I knew I wanted to be a journalist. And it just so happened that Free Press, they had a summer apprenticeship program.
Yeah.
Where they took Detroit students for 20 hours a week for like 10 weeks. And they assigned you two mentors, but you came down to the paper a couple times a week. They taught you about how to write a story, how to interview people, and gave you the basics and the foundation of like what it took to be a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who ran the program, a woman named Dr. Louise Reed Ritchie. Yeah.
That's Louise Ritchie.
You know her?
Of course. She was a mentor for me.
She mentored like basically the whole
everybody.
City.
Yeah. She mentored everybody. Yeah. I mean, I was like, that was my first internship was at the Detroit Free Press officially.
Mm.
I wrote for the Michigan Chronicle. Teen reporter for Michigan Chronicle.
Oh, wow.
And then I had my first official internship at Detroit Free Press. And Louise immediately was like, come here.
Yep. And you know how she is.
Like, yes.
Louise don't play.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You don't say no to Louise.
Mm-mm, you know. Uh-uh. And she was very, like, she had a standard, and you were going to meet that standard. But professionally, having that framework taught me so much. So she's the head of this program. And the very same summer that I did the apprenticeship program, NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, had their convention in Detroit.
Oh.
So she made us join NABJ.
And then you went there.
And then she took us down to the convention. She made us create a resume.
Mm-hmm.
She made us pass out our resume. She
made
us sit there and interview with people. And she made us go up to total strangers and say, she's like, oh, that's the recruiter for this paper. Go up and introduce yourself. And you had to go up and say, hi, my name is Jamel Hill. I'm a junior at Mumford. I want to be a journalist. Like, I did that.
I mean, was that scary?
Terrifying. I was like, what? Like, I was, but again, it, it gave me agency, and I didn't like realize that.
Yeah.
And also a big part of being a journalist is talking to people you don't know.
Exactly.
And so it was a way to get me comfortable in terms of speaking to people and just publicly speaking, period. And that was the foundation for everything. And so from then on, everything I have done has been in pursuit of this career. And I was really fortunate. Hey, most high school kids, they change their mind about their profession 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
Most college students, they change majors,
yeah, yeah,
this and that. But journalism is the only thing I've wanted to do, specifically sports journalism is the only thing I wanted
sports?
To do. Well, I mean, of course, like all kids, like you're first attracted to more of the result. and like the the athletics of it, you know, sort of the drama of sports. Like you're attracted to those things.
Yeah.
Winners, losers, you know, villains, heroes.
It's a clear cut thing.
It's a clear, yeah. So you're attracted to that part of it. You want your team to do well, like the basics. But what I started to uncover the more I learned about it was just like these are these really phenomenal stories about athletes, about where they came from, about what made them motivated to be great. And I didn't figure this out early on, but it was clearly something that I was conscious of. Sports was also a great way to explain the world. I didn't know how to put it in those terms, just in this sense.
Yeah, what do you mean?
So the thing about sports that I think is a misnomer is that people act like the real world is happening here and sports is over here.
Right,
they're the same world, right?
The same world.
And a lot of the things that you've seen in sports have been a microcosm of what's happening in wider society. Sports has often led the way in many regards. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it in the context of Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball in 1947, that was 20 years before, or about 20 years before we got the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights
Act. Right.
Before society started to desegregate, we saw it in baseball. And you know, there are so many inflection points where sports has played a big role in how society sees itself. It's a window into how we see our own humanity.
Do you think sports helps with?
I think it helps a lot.
Okay.
Because the thing about sports is one of the few things as a society we do together.
Right.
Like most things we do, we're very segregated.
Yeah.
Worship, socializing. But you go to a Dodgers game and you will see people from different economic backgrounds, different genders, different races, all there for one common goal, to root for the Dodgers. That's what sports can do.
Yeah.
Other
yeah,
things can't yeah. really do that.
Not theater.
No.
Not movies.
No. Because so that I found to be such a powerful instrument in sports.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write about that. And in addition, you know, like sports provides some real drama.
Yeah.
It's social and political connections aside. Like we have seen drama in sports that has been amazing. And so one of the benefits of my job is that I've been able to witness some moments up close and personal that I'm like, man, I'm really lucky that I get to contextualize this for people that, you know, 30 years from now, when they open up the time capsule or whatever form that takes, they can say like, oh, this is what that was like.
Yeah.
This is what happened. And it's also kind of a great way to historically chart kind of where we are.
Like, you as a black woman, though, as a sports journalist, what's that journey like? Because it wasn't easy, I'm guessing.
No, it was not. It wasn't easy for women, period.
Yeah.
I mean, like when I got in the business, we're talking about the professionally. I mean, because the thing is, I've been able to earn a paycheck as a writer since I was 16 years old.
Oh, wow. Like, that's amazing.
That's very uncommon. Right?
Yes,
like
yes,
I mentioned
yes.
the apprenticeship program.
Yeah,
I wrote
yeah.
a couple of articles then. And then after the apprenticeship program, I answered phones in the sports department. And I wrote a little synopsis of what was happening in high school sports. So I've been able to make a living at this for a long time. But, you know, the thing is, when I really got into the business, they were coming out of a really bad period for women. Like there was a lot of incidents that happened that were alarming and, you know, frankly, sent the message that women weren't allowed in that space.
Yeah.
Right? Because sports is a very, very male space.
Very macho space.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I know that a lot of women tend to work in industries that are dominated by men.
Yeah.
But the sports space is very different because as you said, it's so macho. So they were coming off, you know, some time had passed, but women like had finally gained access to the locker room. And I know people are like, why would a woman be in a man's locker room? Let me explain.
Okay.
So really what people don't understand is that issue was always about time. The thing is, when you write for a daily newspaper, you have a deadline. And so what was happening before they allow women access into the locker room is that the men would be able to go into the locker room. That means you can go in there, interview players, get your quotes.
Yeah.
You get a jump start on your story before a woman could. And that's strictly just based off of gender.
Mm.
Right. And so the women had to wait outside the locker room, which wouldn't have been an issue except for some of the athletes that they were covering resented the presence of women so much that they would skip out on the interviews, they would avoid them, or they come out really late. So then you blow your deadline, then your editor is cussing you out about missing a deadline. So it put men at an unfair advantage.
Right.
That's why they started allowing women into the locker room. And it's a it's something that women had to fight really hard for. And the players weren't happy. I mean, there's all sorts of incidents being told about, like, this one woman, I believe Lisa Olsen, who wrote for the New York Post, she went to her seat in the press box, and it was a dead rat there.
Oh, wow.
So they were doing a lot of things of harassing women just for doing their job.
Anything like that happen to you?
It didn't, because thankfully those women, Lisa Olsen and Claire Smith, a black woman who's a baseball writer. I mean, she's in the Baseball Hall of Fame. She's one of the best baseball writers ever. She went through a lot to get that access. And so I'm standing on the shoulders of them. So by the time I started going into the locker rooms, it was much different. It was no less intimidating, but it was, they were more accustomed to seeing women in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't easy because, like, you know, I went into my first professional male locker room when I was 21 years old, and I was covering an exhibition, an NFL exhibition game. It was the Panthers versus the 49ers. And walking into the locker room, I just was, I almost had a panic attack because, like, I'm accustomed at that point. You know, I had sports internships.
Yeah,
it's not a big deal to be around, you know, sort of athletes. Like, that wasn't the thing of it. But it's just, like, walking into a space like that, I was the only woman in there, the only black woman in there.
Yeah.
And I just felt like when I walked in, the entire locker room turned around, like, you know? And I'm just like a young kid. Like, I'm just in there to get a quote on a late game. Like, I'm like, man, I'm just trying to get in and get out. Like,
right.
I don't care whatever you got going on. Because part of it is that sometimes you will interview athletes. They feel comfortable enough to talk to you when they're naked. Like, it is what it is.
So you have to talk to naked people.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to do that more than a few times. But the best advice a female sports journalist gave me, is she said to me, she's like, where's your notepad? And I showed her my notepad. She took it. She was like, always keep it here because you won't be looking down. And I was like, that makes sense.
Good advice.
So literally, I would go in the locker room like this. Like, I don't want to see nothing. I'm not here for that. Like, trust me. And I think people visualized it as this sort of space where, oh, how thrilling for a woman to go in a man's locker room. Man, it stinks in there. Trust me, the people that you wind up seeing naked are not people you want to see. I ain't trying to see nobody's right guard or left tackle naked. That's just no.
It's not what you
have. Seeing baseball managers naked, like, all the people who shouldn't be naked are the ones naked.
Why are the baseball managers naked?
Because they have their own locker room in there, so they change. You know, like, managers and coaches, they wear full uniform like they out there playing. So they change.
Oh, you know, I never thought about that.
But over time, like anything else, you do it enough times, it's like, I don't care. If you don't care, I don't care.
Right.
And so, and it's interesting now because I read recently about how the NFL is changing its locker room policy, though, that no reporters are allowed in.
Oh, wow.
Which would have been fine, which is fine as long as it's the same for everybody. Right. So the issue before was that one group could go in, but one group couldn't.
Right.
And so that created some drama. But nevertheless, women were kind of coming out of this period. And I'm not saying it was like 100% everything was welcoming, but the time, the most hostile time for women in sports had occurred right before me. So I got the benefit of what they fought for and frankly some of the incidents that they went through. And so any of the issues I ever had with coaches, with players, it was just because I was a reporter, not necessarily because I was a woman reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I've had more funny incidents in the locker room than anything. Like, it was one particular player. We had a good relationship. Like, we had a good rapport. And I was in the locker room, and I'm interviewing him, you know, like, just taking some stuff down. And I heard him whisper my name. And I turn around, and this fool is naked, and he's dancing. He's like, and I was like, boy, nobody care about you. And I just, like, gave him a finger. And we just laughed about it or whatever. Because, like, you know, the thing is, there is, when you're covering a team, and you're with them all the time. You're all on the road together.
Them.
You get to know them. And
yeah.
So if you're doing your job somewhat well, like, some kind of rapport is established. That doesn't mean that I'm going to give you any kind of favorable coverage, but it means, like, we both respect what our jobs, respective jobs are.
Yeah.
And so you know, and years later, like, when I've stopped covering them and I run into them and we just laugh about, you know, things that happen in the locker room or, you know, during the course of covering them over a season. So I have been fortunate enough in that regard. Like, any coach that's cussed me out has just cussed me out just because they didn't like my coverage, not because I was a woman.
Well, let's talk about your coverage. Let's talk about the process and the craft of writing sports stories. Like, can you tell us how that works?
Well, some of it, like in my, and sort of during that time where I was working for newspapers, it's like deadline reporting and deadline coming up with a deadline story is very different than you having a few days or even a few weeks to work on something.
Yeah.
So, you know, typically, let's say I was covering a college football, college basketball game. Game probably starts 7:30, and if it's a marquee game, it starts at 9. Then you have rotating deadlines throughout the night. So it used to be at the Free Press for, if you were living, you know, anywhere in the state, and when you went to your driveway to get the paper, my story had to be in by 11:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
For a game that starts at 7:30 or 9. 9 is like the worst. So, you know, you have just, you have very little time to come up with something to explain to people what happened, why it's compelling, and why they should care.
Yeah.
And
so how do you do it?
So, I mean, for me, one is like during, as I'm watching the game, I'm also sort of taking my own, I'm taking my own play-by-play.
Okay.
So I'm like thinking, and you, what you're doing is like you're sort of segmenting what was the most significant game-changing portions of this game. Like, did they go on, maybe they went on a 15-0 run at one point. Maybe somebody had an exciting alley-oop that kind of started, you know, started like sort of an offensive spurt. Maybe they had lockdown defense where they held the team without scoring for like five or seven minutes.
Right. So all the dramatic points.
So all the dramatic points you point out. And so every game tells a story.
Right.
And so you have to figure out what is the most important story from this game.
You have to figure out who the star is of the story.
Yep.
What the conflict is.
Yep.
Barriers.
Yeah.
All that good stuff.
Yeah, it's no different than, you know, when you write a novel or when you write other things. It's just you have a much shorter time to do it. Now, column writing is different.
Okay.
Because then you're taking either something you've seen observationally.
Yeah.
You know, you're coming from your point of view to discuss and critically relay why something is or why something isn't or what is the tension point, you know, that we're seeing right now. You know, one of the last columns I wrote was about the WNBA. And in particular, something that I noticed as somebody who, the first professional beat I ever covered was the WNBA, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was back in my first job out of college. I was a general assignment sports reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh.
Yeah.
And the WNBA started in 1997.
Uh-huh.
So I was there at the same time. And so they had a team in Charlotte, which is about 2 hours from Raleigh, called the Charlotte Sting. And I asked if I could go down and cover this new league that was popping up. And, you know, so I had institutional knowledge of what it took to create this league, how it was built, you know, covered it for about a year and a half, like understood a lot about it. And here and there I covered women's basketball. So we get to this moment that we're in the WNBA where they're having record viewership. They have a generational talent in Caitlin Clark and also Angel Reese. And so there have, the conversations around them have been so toxic, right? Extremely toxic. And one of the things that I couldn't help but notice is that now that the popularity had exploded, you suddenly had a lot of male commentators who were offering their opinion. The problem is, they didn't have the institutional knowledge, a lot of them. Many of them, and I'm not saying that you need to know every single thing about a sport before you say something, but what would bother me is that they would come in and they would say things as if they were fact, and I know they haven't talked about women's basketball in probably 20 years. Like, they rarely talk about women's basketball, but yet we're supposed to magnify and amplify their opinions over people who have been covering the sport for much
trenches for a long time.
Been in the trenches for a long time. And especially some of the things that they were saying, like accusing the WNBA players of being jealous of Caitlin Clark. And we know what the optics are. Here you have this white woman who's become an incredible talent in a black league. You know, the WNBA is 70% black. So what was the undercurrent is you got all these sisters hating on this white woman. That has been like the overall banner headline for a lot of the conversations around Caitlin Clark. And I just wrote a column about how unfair that was, that some of these male commentators were allowed to offer these opinions that were unsubstantiated become the narrative. And what should be a real celebration for the WNBA to be in existence as long as it has, and to now get the supernova moment that was taken away from them in many respects because of the toxic nature of the conversations created around them. So that, you know, that is sort of how I thought about it.
Yeah. Well, where does that come from? Where did you develop your point of view? I mean, you got to be, first of all, you ain't afraid to go there. Let's just
Brit, that's one.
You are unbothered. You got a whole podcast about it. But where does that come from? Where did you develop that muscle to know, to stand strong in your point of view?
Lived experience. I mean, I came from a household or a family. They argued. I mean, I'm telling you, it was like meet the press every family gathering. Like you be fighting for your life, arguing with my uncle or my mama or my grandma. You know, my mother, she cracked me up because she told me this story about how, because we lived in Houston for about 2 years early on. And I was born and raised in Detroit, but we spent 2 years there when I was like from ages maybe 5 to when I was 7.
Yeah.
And she was telling my grandma, some of our family is at some gathering about Juneteenth. Because, you know, in Michigan, like, I don't know about how it was for you, but I didn't hear about Juneteenth growing up.
No, me neither.
My mother was, you know, it wasn't until we moved to Houston.
Oh, Houston is where it's big
in Texas, right? So, like, I didn't know anything about it. And so my mother was explaining to my grandmother that, like, yeah, we know when technically the date of an emancipation was, mm-hmm. but it took 2 years for that to happen. That is Juneteenth. Right. Like, it didn't happen right away. And my grandmother was not having it. So she was just like, she's like, finally, even though no matter how many books I cited or it's in the encyclopedia.
You sitting up there citing books?
Well, I wasn't. This is my mama arguing with my grandmother. No, this wasn't me. I didn't want the smoke. I did not want to smoke. So she argued with my grandma about it. And she was like, you know, she's like, finally, I just gave up. I was like, shoot, she might be right at this point. Like, maybe the Juneteenth isn't a thing. But the whole point is, like, in our family, a lot of my family members, regardless of education level, had a strong point of view. Like, my grandmother had a strong point of view. My mother had a strong point of view. So seeing them, I think, sort of argue with each other and also defend and stand on what they thought was, you know, something that was informing me that I didn't even know about.
Mm-hmm.
And so fast forward, like, I didn't intend to become a columnist. I wanted to stay, you know, just a journalist and a reporter and that kind of thing. And when I changed over into, or when I pivoted into being a columnist, I got my first column in newspapers when I was 28. I was a columnist for the Orlando Sentinel. The point of view part just kind of came naturally. At that point, you have not only your lived experience, I had my experience as a journalist at that point of like covering different teams, games, knowing the ins and outs of various leagues and understanding understanding sort of the culture of sports. So you bring all that to it and you add a point of view. And people always laugh when I say this, like, I never thought I ever said anything that was really that controversial. And see, I get that same laugh every time I say that.
Come on, Jamil.
No, I really didn't.
Are you serious?
No, because to me, it's just, I realize my mistake is I say it too early. That's what it is. I say it too early.
You said a few things too early.
But then they wind up being true. And I'm like, now see, when I said that, y'all was on me. But now it's good. Okay, I see how it is. So in my mind, as I'm, you know, sort of thinking through my opinions and thinking about how I'm going to support those and write about them, it never seems that crazy to me. And yet, the response to them is often like, you know, I told you all something crazy. And so I do think part of being a good columnist is that you do have to have fearlessness in your writing.
Right, right.
You cannot write to the audience and you cannot write to the room. It's like, this is my point of view. Here's how I'm supporting that. You either like it or you don't. Like, you kind of have to have that.
But is that a lonely position?
Yeah,
to be in?
It can be, because I think how you absorb the criticism and the feedback and the flashpoint, everybody's different. But I'm grateful that when I became a columnist and when I started developing my voice, social media didn't exist. Because I wonder how that would have changed me, how that might have frightened me as a writer. Because a lot of times when I talk to younger journalists, that's the first thing they ask me about. Like, well, what if people don't like it? I don't care if they don't like it. Like, it's just, but again, I'm coming from a different era where, like, you know, where columnists were, you know, you had to be 10 toes down for what you wrote. And like, it's a big difference when you just see your column created, you know, 5 or 6 letters to the editor versus 1,000 Twitter responses or, you know, Instagram comments or people DMing you saying hateful things or Facebook messages. Like, the barrage that these younger columnists and journalists have to face is, like, a lot different.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that by the time that social media came along, I was already really strong in my identity and really strong in my voice, because I don't know how that might have impacted the way that I wrote or the way that I spoke about certain issues if I had to come up and do that now in today's climate. So,
Well, because you've been unbothered all this time, you had a strong point of view. Mm-hmm. You've been able to pivot into things that maybe you'd even plan.
No, I didn't plan any of this. Like, I planned none of this. So I will take no at all credit for being like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to then pivot to producing and developing film and TV projects. Like, no, that was never a part of the plan. But what I started to see, and this sort of light bulb went off after I left ESPN in 2018, was that it was all connected.
You know, it's all storytelling.
It's all storytelling. At the end of the day, it's just like, yeah, okay, the story I might have told 15 years ago was about Chris Paul. Okay, well, today it's about Janie, a character I made up.
Right.
Like, it's no difference. You still have to do the same things. Like, you still have to create tension and drama and compelling situations. And you still have to engage people. Like, that part doesn't change. Mm-hmm. And every story still has these same three components, a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so once I understood the connective tissue, it made the transition seamless. Like, I still write for The Atlantic. I have a new podcast, a sports and politics podcast called Spolitics, that is debuting October 17th on iHeart. And you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You'll also see it on YouTube. And, you know, like, but that's just an extension of the things that I've already been doing. And, yeah, I'm executive producing Colin Kaepernick's documentary that's directed by Spike Lee.
Right.
Again.
Right. An extension.
It's just an extension. Like, I've written, you know, when I was at ESPN, before I actually knew Colin, I was talking about him because of his protests, right?
Yeah.
So I very much understood the nature of the story. And writing about Colin, like, it's the same thing. But I'm just in a producer's role. I'm like, oh, okay, posing questions. Questions that I would have posed as a journalist.
Yeah.
So it's just all very related.
And but what was your process for yourself? You had to write your autobiography, so was that?
Oh yeah, writing a memoir. Man.
Yeah, yeah. What's the memoir like? I mean, how do you turn the objective questioning gaze
on yourself?
On yourself.
Yes, that's a great question, because it's not easy to do.
Yeah.
But the one thing I wanted to be clear about is that I'm not going to ask something of other people that I'm not willing to do myself. Mm-hmm. I ask for transparency in the people I sit down with, or hope I get it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I ask for, you know, them to share their vulnerabilities, all these things that I want when I sit down with somebody that I'm interviewing. So what would it look like if I didn't also give those things? And, you know, I was thinking in my mind as I was writing it, memoirs don't have sequels. So you got to
Put it all out there.
Got to put it all out there. And I also wanted to give people the understanding that the least interesting thing about me is being at ESPN, right?
Yeah, give them the whole story.
Yeah, the least interesting thing about me is that, yes, the president once wanted me fired.
That's
like,
that's the least.
That's the least interesting thing about the life that I've lived. And so so that part was rewarding, but it was hard because I'm used to being on
the other side.
I am used to being on the other side. And, you know, when you're, even when I'm being asked about my opinion or my thoughts on something, it's usually related to, like, sports or politics or something.
Is that a way for you to hide behind?
Well, that's what it becomes. And you don't even realize that. And so I wasn't used to being asked so much about me. And because I wrote such a personal memoir, I'm getting asked about the trauma of my life all the time. So that was a interesting flip, because like one of the stories I tell is about my mother. She's a recovering addict. My father is as well, and I go into detail about this incident where my mother showed me what crack cocaine looks like. So that one thing to share it in the book. Another thing is when you're on, like, in an interview setting and they're like, tell me about the time that mom showed you crack. And I'm like, what? We got to relive this again? Like, it's just sort of like, but that's part of the job. It's like, you're selling a book. You got to slang these books. So
slang these books. You know, Brown.
I'm telling you, I'm out there. I'm just like slanging these books. Okay. And so because of that, like you, but you had to be prepared to be asked that question 500 times. And yeah. So that was very different.
Yeah.
Than my, obviously being on the other side, yeah. And even being, you know, asked about things you're not that emotionally connected to.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the piece that you decided to share with us. This is a section.
Not that part.
No, not that part. Not that part. Yeah. Y'all get the book for that. Let's look at it.
I died when I was 7 years old, just for a few minutes. I wish I could share a memory about what it felt like to be dead, but I don't remember anything. I didn't see a bright light. I didn't see snapshots of past joy and pain. I wasn't sent into a white room, and Morgan Freeman didn't appear to me as God. What I remember most was absolute darkness. It was as if I was in the midst of a deep sleep. I had no conscious thoughts. I didn't feel anything. My mother, James, and I were on our way to the movies to see E.T., the extraterrestrial, which was an uplifting change in our movie going as a family. My parents didn't exactly have the best track record for taking me to movies that didn't traumatize me. Once my mother took me to see Bambi, and when the evil hunter shot Bambi's mother, she and I both started crying uncontrollably. I haven't watched that movie since because I'm still shaken by it. That same year of Bambi, my mother and James took me to see The Empire Strikes Back. From my childlike perspective, Darth Vader was worse than Satan. He seemed like the most menacing, scariest, most powerful, most obnoxious person in the world. I was so terrified by his on-screen presence that I burst into tears before the movie was halfway finished. Darth Vader had me so distraught that we had to leave the theater. Another movie ruined. So when E.T. came out, I was overdue for a movie that didn't turn into something that I would later discuss with my therapist. Unfortunately, I did suffer another traumatic experience. It just didn't happen in the movie theater. We were on our way to the movie when James's black Camaro, a car he absolutely adored, I was in the back seat, and like most kids, I didn't want to put on my seatbelt. My mother wasn't having it, and she nagged me until I did, and thank God. We were driving along the Southfield Freeway service drive, and just as we crossed the intersection at 6 Mile Road, I saw a car coming directly at us, even though our light was green. Then everything went black. I later learned that an 84-year-old man who probably shouldn't have been driving plowed into the passenger side of the Camaro where my mother was seated. He had accidentally hit the accelerator instead of the brake, and I was thrown through the back windshield and landed on the trunk. If I weren't wearing my seatbelt, I would have been catapulted from the car into the street and probably would have died right on the scene. Instead, I waited to die in the hospital. My mother had scrapes, glass in her hair, and a deep bruise on her side that stretched from her hip to the bottom of her breast. But she refused treatment due to my serious conditions. Before I briefly died, I kept telling my mother that my old babysitter, Mrs. Cooper, wanted me to follow her to the store. My mother frantically told me to tell Mrs. Cooper I couldn't go with her. But as I was enveloped in the darkness, I don't recall seeing Mrs. Cooper at all, nor what I said to my mother. My injuries were severe. There was blood rushing from my ear, and my brain was swelling. My skull was fractured, and the hospital's top neurosurgeon had to be flown in from his vacation to operate on me. And in the waiting room, there just happened to be several members of Kojic, Church of God in Christ, and they told my mother that they were all praying for me. God, as he'd always done, was showing up for me in ways I couldn't imagine. I died when I was 7 years old. I don't often talk about it, about the accident, because even now, I'm not sure what to make of it. The question that lingered has been, why? Why did God still allow me to be here? What was my purpose?
Well, that is something. I had to say, I was like, oh man, like that is quite dramatic, you know? Yeah, you know, I thought I sent you another scene, and now I realize, but there was some levity in there.
Yeah, there was.
Yes, because only I could crack some jokes about dying, basically. But yeah, that was like an important inflection point in my life. And, luckily, the seriousness of the injury was such that, like, it's impossible to imagine like what that must have felt like for my mother. As a young kid, like, you're not fully aware of the danger sometimes that you're in. I just remember, like, we were heading down the service drive, everything went black, and when I woke up, I had two black eyes and half my head was shaved, and I had no clue what had just happened. And upon, you know, reflection, and especially hearing my mother's account, you know, and that was the other thing about this memoir. And when people have asked me, like, oh, what do you want people to take away? I was like, the number one thing I want people to take away is that while your parents and your loved ones are still here, ask them everything you can. Mm. And a lot of times we don't, especially when you've been in the position of being the child your whole life. There's sort of an innate selfishness that comes with that, because everything's all about you. Everything's all about you being taken care of, and, you know, various things like that. And so what you wind up doing is not having those conversations with your mother or your father, yeah, about not just who they were when they were your parents, but who were they before you ever came into their lives. And one thing that I've been really grateful about this memoir is that it allowed my mother and I to have like hours long conversations. And I got her perspective of the things that I was going through at that point. Because really our stories are very much related. Like there's all sorts of stories in this book that I never knew that my mother had, mm-hmm, to go through. And so I'm really grateful from that standpoint, is that I have a deeper and fuller understanding of what her traumas were, why she parented the way that she did. And even it gave me a window into some of the conflict that we sometimes have. It's like, mm-hmm, oh, I get it now, because now I understand your perspective. And I'm really glad that I'm a trained journalist, because I think if I wasn't, I would approach it differently. But having that journalism background allowed me to, in
have
a good
some
way,
distance.
Yeah, have some distance, yeah, and passionately treat my mother as a subject. And I think, right, that was really good for the book.
Is it good for your relationship?
Yeah, it was. Like, it definitely was. One of the highlights I think I experienced was me and my mother doing Red Table Talk. Mm-hmm. Like, that was great. I mean, I was daughter of the year, because she got to meet Jada Pinkett and Will Smith. Like, she was very excited about this. But just being able to kind of share this with her to where she can see her story being told too is just really priceless. So, yeah, it definitely brought us, I think, closer together, because she was able, and she's always been a pretty transparent person.
Yeah.
But I realized up until now, I was never asking her the right questions. This made me ask her the right questions that got me to a deeper understanding of who she was.
And have you asked yourself the right questions?
I had to during this book, that's for sure. And it's funny because, like, sometimes, and I guess this is the nature of healing, is like you'll feel like, oh, I'm healed from that. I'm past that. Or,
yeah, what was it when you, I know you said that was dramatic, but what did it bring up for you when you were hearing
it? You have some like doors and boxes that you're like, this is closed. I'm good. I put this away. And then,
yeah.
To open up and to remember them. Like, it was times where I was like crying and writing, you know what I'm saying? It was just like, oh, I thought this would feel differently. And it was just as fresh as if it just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And because to me, to write really honestly, I had to put myself back in those moments of vulnerability. And the one thing that I have always struggled with is vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of women have,
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
of Black women especially.
Well, I mean, knowing a little bit about your background and how you grew up, that becomes like a defense mechanism. You have to not show the vulnerability because you don't know what they're going to do with it, first
mm-hmm,
of all.
Mm-hmm.
I need to protect myself. So you kind of walk around kind of walled off. And then journalism allows you to have distance and be objective, even when you're thinking about your own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I can see that. It's become something that's made you a great journalist.
Right.
But it's something that you have to work on as...
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's something you just have to be self-aware about and just say, like, hey, you know, what the one thing, I think it was a therapist, not my therapist, who pointed this out, is that a lot of us are still protecting that, in my case, the little girl that
mm-hmm.
we were.
Yeah.
So it's like if we seem particularly passionate or strong or sometimes... you know, even mean about a situation.
Right.
Some of it is because that situation might be triggering us to a memory from when you were a little girl and you didn't fight for yourself and you didn't.
Oh, you didn't have the power to.
Because you didn't have the power to.
Right.
And so I didn't realize that was a pattern I was doing. Not that I'm just like going off on people. It wasn't like that.
Exactly.
But I found myself in what were innocuous moments, probably being like overly defensive because I'm still thinking about that little girl who didn't have a voice, who couldn't fight for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so recognizing and just understanding that part is just like, oh, this is illuminating. Now I know what the signs are when I do this.
Yeah, that's an ongoing work in progress.
It is. And just, you know, I mean, I think being raised, especially, you know, I was raised by a single mother.
Me too.
Estranged from my father for a little while until he sort of came back into my life. And when you're raised that way, is that because she has no choice, your mother is trying to give you every possible tool to ward off every possible danger they can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that it makes you very guarded.
Yes.
It makes you guarded. Or as the kids say now, like, you know, you learn to just carry masculine energy.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. And don't let us be tomboys, because then that's
a whole nother thing, right? Because, and maybe that is part of why I was, you know, sort of drawn, to sports. It's like, you know, it sports teaches you how to stand up for yourself. Like,
and sports also has a clear winner.
Yes.
Life doesn't.
No, it does not. So, like, all of those things, among the many things I loved about this memoir is, like, it helped me understand myself better.
Yeah.
And so for that, it was worth it. I mean, it was a daunting, you know, sort of
so
process.
How did you approach it? What was your process in writing it?
So the two best pieces of advice I got about writing a memoir came from two wildly different people. Okay. One was Walter Mosley.
Okay.
Which makes a lot of sense because he's a prolific author.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the other was Rick Ross. Doesn't make a lot of sense to Mosley.
No, it doesn't.
So both of them were guests on Jemele Hill is Unbothered.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Walter about writing. And he said no matter where he is in the world, he writes for at least 2 hours a day. And
2 hours.
Like, well, that's why you got 50-11 books. Because okay. That's what you do. That's why. Okay. And he said he made it click for me as seeing writing as a discipline. And I know that might sound weird to people. They're like, you've been writing your whole life. But when you write for like newspapers and magazines, like that's different because it's like so deadline based.
Deadline driven.
And you know, writers, we the worst procrastinators. Like it is, some of it, just the worst. Because, like, if you tell me that to file a story 10 a.m., I'm filing it at 9:59:59. Like, I don't know what it is that does not click in my brain. Like, you could do this earlier and probably save yourself a lot of stress. No, right. I have to do it, you know, like I'm in some old newspaper scene and my editor's yelling at me, like, in a second, it'll be done. Like, you know, so you write by feel. And that's not good to do when you have a book because you have a deadline that you have to complete. And so I was just like, I got to put myself on a schedule. Mm. And I wasn't writing that way. Like I would write 50 pages of it in 2 days and then wouldn't touch it for 2 weeks. Mm-mm. Like you can't write.
You ain't going to finish it like that.
You'll never finish it. Thank you. Moniece, where were you then?
Call me, girl. I couldn't tell you.
Where were you then? All right. So the early part of when I first started, like, sort of putting things down, that was dramatically different by the time I finished. I was on a schedule, you know, getting up 6 a.m., writing, coming back in the evening, writing, designated times to write. Save my life. Thank you, Walter Mosley. The other part is that when you think about the whole totality of your life, first question you have is what to include, what not to include.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
important, what's not important. Rick Ross told me, because he was writing his memoir at the time, or somebody was writing it for him rather, but he was, you know, obviously engaged in the process. He said, I broke my life down into 16 parts. The 16 most important moments in my life, we just wrote around that. I was like, damn, that is so simple. So I did the same thing. The number wasn't 16. I think it was more like 12.
Okay.
Where I just like wrote about, okay, what are the most important inflection points in my life? That's why that accident is in there, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, the thing, if you almost die,
that's
important to share, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, that the apprenticeship program changed my life.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going through and I'm like, oh, okay. And the story started to form. The beginning, middle, and the end started to form once
right,
I did that.
Right.
And once I had that part, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, I see it now. And my first draft that I turned in was quite long. Mm-hmm. It was 400 pages. Mm. But I did that on purpose because I was like, you know, I'm going to have a little bit of a kitchen sink approach mm-hmm. because just in case I'm wrong about the incidents that should be in there or the moments that should be in there, let me at least provide a little bit more
cushion.
A little bit more cushion. And the notes I got back from my book editor were great. And the next draft I filed, it was like 260 pages. I was able to lock it.
You had a trim.
Just that.
That's where the adjectivity came in. You were able to just say, this ain't working, this ain't working.
Yeah. Right. And then I started to really see the story. Mm-hmm. Like, again, like, I could really see it. Like, oh, yeah, it needs
to. You were able to see it outside of yourself.
Outside of myself. Like, I was like, okay, I know where this needs to end. Mm-hmm. I know where it stops. And so, once I had that part down, all the edits after that were pretty painless.
Mm-hmm.
The most painful part was the first draft. And I remember talking to Lovie Jones, and who's written a few bestsellers, and she said, listen, and this made me feel better because I didn't like the first draft that I turned in, the first manuscript. She's like, your first draft is supposed to suck.
It's supposed to be crap.
Right. That's what she said. She was like, it doesn't matter. Like, that is not going to be the final product.
Right.
And because, again, when you come from a journalism world, it's like, you don't have the luxury of filing crap. Like you got.
Yeah, yeah. It's right? got to be right.
It's got to be
right.
It's going
to press.
Because it's going to press. Or like it might go through one or two edits and then boom, it's gone. And she's like, no, like your first draft. She's like, my first draft, so all my books are crap. Like it's fine. Like it'll get better as you go. And she was right. And so all these things were very instructive, you know, for me. So I'm glad I started with writing that first because I was like, oh, if I can go through this, I've survived this. I have so much more I can write. So, but it's funny to go from that juxtaposition to now working on a children's book.
Yeah.
Total opposite.
First of all, kids don't give you no love. You got to come. You got to come correct. They will call you out on your stuff. On my children's book,
oh,
I wrote my children's book. And when I would go and I would read it, perform it for the kids, you got to give it to them.
Here's a ruthless.
They will call BS on you in a second.
Did you have to do voices and all that kind
of?
Oh, wow.
And I wrote mine like a Dr. Seuss, like, poetry thing. And I had to streamline it and make it simple, but be very creative.
Yeah.
You got to be very creative for kids. Is that your process
as
well?
Yes. No, you're right. Well, and not on the conciseness that you have to write with is way different because what sells the children's books are the illustrations.
Yes.
Like the illustrations are actually more
prominent. It's not about the words.
It ain't about the words. And I, so I had to let that go and be like, it ain't about the words.
This is how I make my living.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, no, it's not about the words. I was like, oh yeah, all right, I guess it's not about the words. And then it's the tone of your writing that's mm-hmm. very different. Like I just mm-hmm. went from writing this like very heavy memoir.
Yes.
And generally speaking, the things I write about for The Atlantic are like on the heavier side mm-hmm. of like, show, you know, talking about some drama or some tension and, you know, writing about the intersection between sports, race, culture, and gender, like totally different. With kids, as I learned, you have to pretend the world isn't on fire because you have to give them something, a reason to believe and hope. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, what is hope? No, what is this hope thing? Okay. It's like, I can't write like a cynic. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So that in itself to me was an exhilarating challenge. The, changing the language of that was really fascinating.
Yeah.
And writing much shorter,
mm-hmm.
also very fascinating. So, so yeah, it's a totally different process. It's, I mean, it may sound weird because like, as you know, you're writing, you know, I mean, like my memoir may be 260 pages, something like that. I mean, this children's book total, I think is maybe 2,500 words, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, and so learning to sometimes take really bold, big concepts that might be too much for kids and boiling them down to something small is a challenge, a great challenge, I think, yeah. as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have enjoyed this so much, Jamil.
Same.
I'm going to ask you two more questions.
Okay.
Though. Okay. One, what advice would you give little Jamil? little Jamil. Talk to her for me for a second.
Well, I think the number one advice I would probably give her, and it's something that you know, it sounds a little, I guess, Pollyannish, but like to bet on you. Like mm-hmm. I didn't really learn how to bet on me till later in my career, I think, and I wish I would have been more practiced at it starting younger. I mean, mm-hmm. in some ways, yes, I did bet on myself for sure, because I'm a black girl from Detroit trying to be a sports writer. That's
yeah,
like not
yeah. that's
you
a
know,
lot. Yeah,
that's a lot, and it's not very typical. Like, mm-hmm. you know, what business did I have doing that? So my naivete worked for me in a lot of regards. But there are so many other ways I could have been betting on myself sooner. And I wish I had the confidence to do that. Mm-hmm. So I would just encourage, you know, little Jamil to just to really tap into that and to understand that, you know, you are you for a reason.
Yeah.
Like everybody else is taken.
Yeah,
you're exactly. you, and so bet on you.
Right.
Yeah, bet on you for sure. So that'd be probably a big part of it.
Okay, and what advice would you give to people who are listening, some writers who are trying to find their own point of view?
You know, so much of what you'd be surprised what you accomplish if you just keep going. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we miss out on the awareness, the epiphany, the thing that where we're like, oh, okay, this is what it means to have a voice, and it's not just one moment too, like. I do get asked that question a lot. It's like, how did you find your voice? It wasn't one moment. It was a series of little victories and little moments where, because of the way they worked out, it gave me more confidence to try it again.
Yeah.
And then try it again bolder.
Yeah.
My old television partner, Michael Smith, used to say this about TV, and I took it to heart. You don't get better at being, you don't get better at TV. You get better at being you on TV.
Mm.
There's a difference, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. what I would say to people is get better at being you.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever in your writing, whether you're having a broadcast career, podcasting career, whatever that is, that should be your focus. And as you know, sort of have these moments where things go well, it's like, whether they be big or small, understand that the next time you try that, you need to do it bolder. You need to dig in harder.
Okay.
You need to do it more fearlessly. Like, keep upping the stakes.
Right.
Because by the time you get to a certain point, you will fully feel like yourself and like you're fully who you are when you show up to do that thing that you do.
Right. Yeah.
So that's my advice.
Okay.
And if you're young and in college, do not ruin your credit for a $3 t-shirt. Not a good idea.
You know, you're just going to end with that.
I am like, do not do it, people. I know that they have the free t-shirts.
Oh, the little booth.
Yeah, don't go there. Do not go there. Avoid that. Avoid those booths at all costs. I don't care what they're offering you. Don't sign up. Don't fall for it. Wait until you actually have like a real job before you do that. You're just asking for the dead. Trust me, I know. I only tell you what I've done, okay? So don't do it.
Oh, man. Thank you, Jamil. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming
you.
On.
I appreciate it. That was fun. Thank yeah. you. Such great questions. Such a good conversation. Thank you so much.
That was great.
Yeah.
Bam, I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for supporting Works in Progress. See you next time.